Good morning and welcome. Thank you for participating in this year's Women's Health and Halacha Day, another outstanding success. So we're so grateful that you're here and have an interest in all of these topics. The topic we're going to discuss this morning, please God, is one which is very irrelevant for all of us for a long time, for our family members, hopefully one that we will not have to face. But it's really critical and it's important, and it's wonderful that you're here, because unfortunately way too many people only confront and learn about these issues in real time when they are dealing with them, and one does not have the headspace, one is not in a great emotional place to really be understanding and to be analyzing and to be absorbing these issues at that time. So I think it's great that you're here, and it's wonderful that we included this topic in the Women's Halacha Day, Health and Halacha Day, because it's an important one. I am excited and proud to share this slot with my good friend, Rabbi Dr. David Shabtai. You know Rabbi Shabtai as the rabbi of our Sfaradic Minyan, but Rabbi Shabtai is also really provided nachas to his family, because he's not only a rabbi, he's also a doctor. Rabbi Shabtai earned his medical degree from Einstein.
NYU.
From NYU.
Close.
NYU. Yeah, there you go. From NYU. And though he never practiced, he is viewed as an authority in issue of bioethics and medical ethics. In fact, if you like, I will shamelessly plug his book, since he probably won't. But he has a wonderful and arguably the authoritative book on the issue of brain death from a halachic perspective. It's not like an easy read on the couch after a cholent on a Shabbos. It's a thick book, it's an encyclopedic book, it's a highly academic book, but it really is the most thorough and comprehensive book on the subject that is not predisposed to any bias or any opinion or any agenda, but really is analyzing it from a purely Torah perspective and providing all of the sources and all of the perspective. So it's great to have Rabbi Shabtai, who brings not only the halachic background, but the medical background as well. And really, I defer to him on many of these issues. So what I want to begin with is by addressing some of the pastoral issues, some of the rabbinic issues. Coming at this, not throwing at you lots of tshuvas and lots of gemaras and lots of sources from a halachic analysis, but telling you some of the bottom lines, telling you some of the practice and the reality that people face in this area. And there couldn't be a better time. It wasn't scheduled this way on purpose, but we now find ourselves in the week of Parshas Vayechi. And in Vayechi, Yaakov Avinu, our great patriarch, perhaps really set a precedent for the topic in this session, because at the end of his life, towards the end of his life, he began to plan. Yaakov didn't experience his demise and leave to his children afterwards to explore for themselves what to do, but Yaakov planned for his own death. Yaakov called his family around his bed. He gave out blessings. He gave out a specific charge and mandate to each of his children, to his grandchildren. So Vayechi Yaakov, in his life, Yaakov planned for his death, and really in that way provides the precedent and provides the inspiration to all of us. And that's the first thing that I want to point out, is that what Yaakov did is something that's often neglected today. We'll talk about it in a moment, and people talk about halachic living wills, or a healthcare proxy, that in your life and while you're well, to articulate and clearly communicate and transmit to your next of kin, whoever it may be, what your will, what your wishes are. And that's something which has grown in popularity, that's something which is being spoken about more often. But a ethical will, to leave a charge to your family, to your children, not only about how you want to be treated in end-of-life situations, and not only about how they should distribute your assets and your portfolio among themselves, but to leave them an ethical will, to talk about your values and your life and your priorities, your hopes and your dreams for them, to tell your children, your grandchildren, please God, achieve the longevity of great-grandchildren, that you'd like them to explore Israel, or you want them to participate in this trip, or you want their education to go this far, or what was important to you, that you volunteered for the Chevra Kadisha, or the Chesed, or you were part of starting the day school, or helped lead the mikvah. Who were you, and how does that translate into what you hope for them? What Yaakov did, which was incredible, Yaakov's brachas, and I don't want to take the time for this now, but Yaakov's brachas are highly unusual if you look at them, because Yaakov actually offers criticism to his children. With each of the children, as he calls them close to give them this bracha, he tells them where they think they're deficient, what they need to work on. Shimon and Levi, you're impetuous, and this one, this, and that. And really, in a certain degree, that's the ultimate blessing a parent can give a child, is to try to support and to try to give a child some direction of where they think their unique talents and life mission lies, how they can realize it, their hopes and aspirations for that child. So the first point I wanted to make is that in thinking about end of life, one puts a lot of focus on their will. They meet with estate planners, they do all of their tax planning, they set up trusts and revocable, irrevocable trusts and reverse mortgages, and all kinds of planning happens towards the end of life. But we neglect perhaps the most important part of our legacy, which is not the money. Because unfortunately or sadly, within years after a person's gone, the children or the next generations are enjoying that money, but with every dollar they're not necessarily remembering where it came from. But the real legacy we leave is not something which can be evaluated in numbers. The real legacy we leave are our values. And so the importance of writing it. We have many of our great rabbis in the past who did so. They actually recorded their ethical will. I think there's a book, I don't know. I think there's a sefer that is that combines the ethical wills, the tzavas, of many of our great rabbis in history. And so that is all point number one. Point number two. I'll never forget, a number of years ago, a woman in our community who was single, never married, never had children, passed away suddenly. In fact, she was discovered in her own home by a neighbor after she hadn't responded for a few days. And I went to the home, and I knew she had a brother. That was all I knew. She had a brother. And immediately, obviously, wanted to figure out, were there any plans? Was there a cemetery plot? Was there a package, pre-need package that was paid for with a funeral home? Alerting the brother to this tragic news of his sister's demise. And I had to shuffle and go through paperwork all over the apartment. I couldn't so much as easily find her brother's phone number, let alone whether there were any plans. And I wrote an article that week, and it continues to be something that I try to promote. One of the greatest gifts that you can leave, if you're blessed to have children, grandchildren, a spouse, a friend, whatever the circumstance, is to gather together and organize everything that would be necessary, from funeral home arrangements to cemetery plots to where the bank accounts are to the life insurance to who to contact to the deed to the house to the combination to the safe to everything that a person, passwords, right? There's a whole now, like what your Facebook password, there's a whole question actually. People die and the children want to shut down the account or put a message and legally they can't pass. You know, Facebook, for example, can't give the password to the next generation. So a very, very important point. One of the greatest acts of chesed, the greatest gifts that you can give your family is to organize everything. And I'll even go so far as to tell you, on no basis whatsoever, it's a school for arichas yamim. Don't think that it's a ayin hara. Oh, if I start to record that and I tell them where that folder is, oh, it's an ayin hara. No, it's a school for arichas yamim. If you do that, then you live a long, long life. I know this is the Women's Health and Halacha Day, and often it works out in the reverse, where a husband pays all the bills, and if he suddenly gets sick and he's incapacitated, now no one knows where the bills, where the bank account, who the insurance, what's happening. But it sometimes happens in the reverse. So I'll tell you, it's so, so important when considering end-of-life situations. It's a matter of being considerate. It's a matter of a chesed, is to organize as much as possible with contact information, with account numbers, with addresses, with everything that a person might be searching for that will make their life in their time of grieving easier and will be able to provide them some direction. Yes?
I have a tip for everybody. Baruch Hashem, my mom just turned 90 a week ago. She's in wonderful health, thank God. We bought her a book that we got from Amazon. I think it was 1995, called When I'm Gone. Very simplistic. It's just the book you're talking about.
Okay, great. When I'm Gone?
When I'm Gone.
Fantastic.
I don't remember the author. It's a hardcover book. Every possible line has a different directive of what you need to put in that space. So it's very easy to fill in.
Fantastic. Okay, thank you for that tip. Just a couple more points, and I want to hand it off to Rabbi Shabtai. Yes?
What I and a bunch of my friends have done is the same way we put our recipes.
So
we put our recipes like in a notebook, in sleeves. We did this and we entitled the notebook, in a loose leaf notebook, I made the esrim.
Nice. Okay? So a school of Arichas Yamim. A school of Arichas Yamim. Okay, I mentioned the healthcare proxy, the halachic living will. Again, as an active rabbi, I often encounter families who are engaged in end-of-life decisions, and by the time the patient is in a position that decisions need to be made, they're no longer capable of directing them. And now you have family members who are, in the best scenario, trying to intuit and to guess what their loved one would want, and in the worst situations, are actually fighting about it. And nobody wants to leave their loved ones with a sense of animosity or conflict while they're already going through the trauma of losing someone they love. So a halachic living will, a healthcare proxy, you can find it through the RCA, its website, rabbis.org. Agudas Yisrael has its version. There are a number of versions. But by filling it out, one accomplishes two things. Number one, rather than leave it to the doctors, the nurses, or hospice, to the healthcare industry to determine what will happen to you, it legally obligates decisions to be made by whomever is directed. So in the halachic living will, it is a halachic authority. It's a rabbi. There's a rabbi which is named. There's a backup rabbi. It's a legal document which is signed and notarized. Once you do have it, I would encourage you to give it to the rabbi that you name so he has it on file. I would leave it on file with your primary doctor. In the event that a person is hospitalized, it should be something which the hospital is notified about. Because again, the things that are indicated in the halachic living will, it's too late afterwards to tell them about it. There are real-time decisions that have to be made, and the better that the community of people involved are informed, the better that they can make sure that the will of the patient themselves is being met. So number one, it directs decisions to be made through the prism of halacha, that halacha is the guiding factor in the decisions that are being made. But number two, there is a level of autonomy, and the different halachic living wills have a different degree of autonomy they provide. But a person is able to indicate what degree of intervention, what degree of effort they want in order to prolong their life. There are non-negotiables, and there are negotiables. Rabbi Shabtai will speak about that more in a moment. A person can't say, I want to be deprived of nutrition and oxygen. If I'm miserable, I want you to take out a gun and shoot me because I don't want to live that way. So just drive over me with a tractor because I don't want to live that way. Right? There's no airway in halacha that would allow such a thing. So on the one hand, you cannot say, I want you to take my life. And by the way, deprive me of oxygen and nutrition is another way of saying I want you to either starve me to death or suffocate me to death. So there are non-negotiables, but there are within halacha negotiables that a person can decide. I wouldn't want to be intubated in a way that it could never be reversed. I wouldn't necessarily want to start dialysis in a way that it could never be stopped. And these are more complicated issues. Rabbi Shabtai will address them in a moment. But I wanted to bring the overall umbrella point that it's important, and it's not too soon, to have in place a halachic living will, again, because we don't, diagnoses and accidents don't come based on our calendar and schedule. We don't time them, and we don't schedule them. So knowing that it is filled out and it is in place will protect oneself from a halachic perspective and will protect legally that one's interests are the ones that will be carried out and that will be met. Once you're putting together this file that has your ethical will and it has your halachic living will and it has your bank accounts and your life insurance policy and the cemetery plot and so on, there's another piece I would encourage you to put in there, and those are your burial wishes. Your burial wishes. I would indicate, it could be short form through bullets, that would you like, if you have such wishes, is it a graveside service? Is it a chapel service? Do you want everyone to speak? Do you want few speakers? But even the basic things, and obviously if you're from a more observant Torah background and your family's all on the same page, it may not be as much of an issue, but many people have diverse family and offspring. But to indicate you want a tahara, you want the halachic burial preparations, you want a shomer, that you'd ask your children to sit the full shiva, or that you want Kaddish to be recited for you, don't take anything for granted. Whatever can be communicated and transmitted, put it down on paper, put it in that file, and make sure that there's no room for debate, there's no room for doubt, but what it is you want is something that you can have there. I know somebody who in this file they left for their child, bless you, they even indicated a few points they would like said at their funeral. Now I want to point out, Not in an ego way, not in an ego way of I want you to talk about how great I am, but these are things in my life which I think are important and I want my future generations to know. Who were the greatest role models in my life? Who were the biggest influences in my life? How did I end up becoming religious even though my parents were, or my parents' sacrifices to send me to school? This person recorded some of that, put some notes and said, after 120 years, when the world will learn about my life, and most important to me, my children, my grandchildren and great-grandchildren will learn about my life, this is what I want to be said. And that sounds humorous in a certain extent. I mean, if you put on there, mention I was the head of the PTA and that I volunteered this and I gave this much money, and you're right, that would be something which we wouldn't admire. But to say, I want my great-grandchildren to know that these were the influences in my life or these were the major moments in my life is not something that we should scoff at all. A halachic living will can include issues of a DNR and DNI. Now, it depends when one is filling that out. DNR is a do not resuscitate order. DNI is a do not intubate order. Too many people think that halacha categorically rejects the possibility of either of these. These are non-Jewish ideas that you can have an order of do not resuscitate. A do not resuscitate means that a person goes into cardiac arrest, they do not want intervention to bring them back. Now, if you have a healthy individual, for me to have a DNR order would, of course, be absurd, ethically, morally, and halachically. But there are circumstances, too nuanced to address fully or universally or generically, but there are circumstances where a person has a terminal illness or is suffering in an irreversible way, that doctors have determined that if their heart were to stop, they could not recover what we'll call a meaningful quality of life from a halachic perspective. And so to say, don't work on them, don't bring them back to life to be a vegetable, is something which halachically is legitimate. And DNI would be, do not intubate, would follow along similar lines. Rav Shabtai will address that more fully in a moment. The same is true with hospice. People think that hospice is a non-Jewish concept, that it's incompatible with Judaism or halacha. It happens to be that some of the ethic of hospice and some of the latest culture of hospice, the culture in the medical community today, I find it constantly in the hospital and interacting with different healthcare professionals, is that to keep someone alive is cruel, to help them die without suffering is kind. And that is a culture and an ethic which is the antithesis of our view. That doesn't mean that we have to prolong suffering, and it doesn't mean that we have to seek to continue life by any measure. Of course, we're sensitive in making these determinations, but the Judaism places an incredible value, the highest value, on every moment of life. You know, and that's why you're allowed to save a person's life on Shabbos, even if you know that they're only going to extend their life by a moment, because every moment of is of inestimable value. And so one has to be very aware that towards the end of life, both in a hospital setting and a hospice setting, our loved ones, or towards 120, we need an advocate. You need an advocate who is going to advocate on your behalf, who is going to step in and stop some of what is considered today kindness and compassion, from our perspective, is cruelty. So there's an element of an olam hafuch. There's an element in the culture today of an upside-down world. There are nurses and doctors, there are hospices in our community that are amazingly sensitive and supportive, and they're wonderful. And I don't mean to paint a broad stroke for all of them, but we need to be aware that we are confronting this culture, and we need to advocate and be advocated for to make sure that the interests of our loved ones, from a halachic, moral, and emotional perspective, are being addressed. These are some of the overall issues. I'm going to hand it off to Rabbi Shabtai, who will get into a little bit more of the medical perspective. He'll speak for approximately 15 minutes or so, and then we'll take questions.
Give me quite the list for 15 minutes. Okay. Good morning. Thank you, Rabbi Goldberg. It's always interesting just to learn from Rabbi Goldberg the pastoral aspects. He's dealing with this as a rabbi with a community for so many years that there's really a lot to learn about it. So he gave me quite a lot to talk about in the next 15 minutes. So I'm going to talk about what I want to talk about first. Then we'll get to what he said. So I always thought I was comfortable talking about death. I talk about death all the time. I learn about death. I sat in yeshiva for many years. I wrote a book about brain death. At home, we talk about defining the moment. You can get it on Amazon. You can search my name or defining the moment at Amazon. And so at one point, my wife thought, maybe it is enough. If you want to do bioethics, medical ethics, that's great. They're happier topics, you know, beginning of life. There's all sorts of greater things to do. Maybe you should look at beginning of life. So I went to yeshiva the next day, sat down with my chavrusa, and I said, you know, my wife thinks this is a little bit too morbid. You know, we're always death. Maybe like something about the beginning of life. Said, fine, and we started learning about abortion. So, okay, whatever. So it's something that I talk about, not from the pastoral aspect of trying to deal with people in the moment. So when we're thinking about it ahead of time, sometimes we can try to think about it without getting too emotionally involved. And one of the things that's important in end-of-life care, and Rabbi Goldberg mentioned it, that the culture of hospice, is that so many of the decisions that have to be made aren't actually medical decisions at all. They're decisions about medicine, about therapy, about what procedures I want, I don't want, what needs to be done. And there are important factors to consider. Well, what's the chance of this therapy working? Well, what's the likelihood if we do this, if we pursue this course of treatment, well, what's the chances of X outcome, what's the chances of Y outcome? Those are all numbers and facts. Numbers and facts don't tell you what you should do or what's the right thing to do. Most of these decisions, many, I won't say all, but many, are about values, about what we feel, about morals and ethics. Is this right or wrong? Is this the right thing to pursue? Is this what I believe in? It's not a medical judgment. We've come to a point where the doctors are making a lot of these, medical staff is making a lot of these decisions for us. This isn't worthwhile, don't do it. Well, that could be. But what does it mean when something isn't worthwhile? Well, what's it worth to you? Is it worth it or not? I understand there's a cost associated with it. I understand there's effort expended on it. But is the outcome worth it or not? Well, I might disagree with you about that. I might have a very valid perspective about what's worthwhile to do. Is this, you know, is this person suffering or not? And even if they are, would they want to suffer or would they not want to suffer? Some people might say, you know, under certain circumstances, I'm willing to undergo X if I can extend my life by a little bit. I get calls from all over the place on these end-of-life issues. You have someone whose granddaughter is getting married in a week. And so they want a little bit. They understand it's not comfortable. And they want to... So is it worth it then for that extra week? Or not? So we might disagree. It's a judgment that one person might say yes, one person might say no. But it's true in every circumstance. Is something worth it or not? It's a question of values and ethics. It's not a question of facts. And when it comes to values and ethics, it's important to recognize that every single person in this room has equally a valid opinion as any medical staff. We might not know all the facts. We might not say, well, what are the chances of this succeeding? We need all the facts. You know, you need to make a correct judgment. You need to have all the information available to you. But we shouldn't be so quick to just adopt everything that's happening just because it's told to us. The culture of hospice, I've been told by a bunch of physicians that are associated with one of the hospices here. So what is hospice? Hospice is a Medicare benefit that kicks in when a person is deemed to have 6 months or less to live, that a doctor has to sign off that a patient, in their best estimate, has 6 months left or 6 months or less. It's not always true. It's a guess. It's an estimate. And then hospice kicks in, and they take over the care of the patient. Now, when the person opts for the Medicare benefit of hospice, by law, they have to give up on any therapeutic care. Their insurance, Medicare, will not cover any continuing therapeutic care. So if a person has cancer, Rachman al-Itzlan, and it's terminal, and there's nothing else to do, but they want to try another round of chemo or something like that, they cannot. They have to choose. There's a choice that needs to be made legally between hospice and therapeutic care. There's a movement going on now. Maybe we should really think about that. Hospice is supposed to be about helping a person, taking care of a person, taking care of a person's whole person, not just treating the cancer, but treating the person emotionally, spiritually, socially. And so there's not really a conflict between the two, but practically speaking, there is. Practically speaking, you can't qualify for one if you're still qualifying for the other. And so once a person enters hospice, so there's home hospice, in-hospital hospice, so many of the opinion of, well, a person's going to die anyway, you're not pursuing therapeutic treatment, so why bother doing a lot of different things? Some of the physicians told me in the hospice they were associated with, the average stay in hospice is less than 24 hours. Which means, this is anecdotes, not real data, but that means that either we're really, 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 really good at predicting when the last 24 hours of a person's life are, which is pathetic if you think about it, because then we should have admitted them to hospice, you know, earlier so they could benefit from it, or something here is going on that we may or may not be comfortable with. So it's just something to think about. Now, not every hospice is like that, of course not. But there's a culture, and it needs to be dealt with. I know when I was in New York, I'm not terribly familiar with all the hospices here, and I know Rabbi Goldberg was telling me there are hospices that we work with. I know in New York, there's hospices that are associated now with Yeshiva University. It's actually run by the Catholic Church. That are very Calvary Hospital.
Calvary, yes.
And it's run by the Catholic Church. You walk in there, there's a picture of every... I've never seen so many popes in my life. There's crosses on every wall. They're wonderful, wonderful people. They have a relationship with YU, with the yeshiva, and they have as a policy that if you opt, they will consult with whoever you want, and they will work together. They have two Jewish Orthodox chaplains, they have Reform chaplains, they have everybody. They have imam, they have everybody under the sun. It's a Catholic place. But they're willing to work with you no matter what you want to do, because they understand that different people come from different cultures, and this is questions of values, not of facts, and people come with different values, and they're willing to respect them. It's something that we need to think about. And in terms of just one last thing that Rabbi Goldberg mentioned about advocacy, that people need someone to advocate for them. So often, this happens a lot. You need this not only in end-of-life care, but in all of life care, and so it's important that someone always be with someone in the hospital. Not necessarily 24 hours a day, but it's important that someone be there to advocate, because the patient... You have to realize the reason that we talk about these things now, as Rick Goldberg mentioned, is because now we can think about it rationally. We have time. We're not in the heat of the moment. Imagine what it's like for a patient who's in the heat of the moment. They're under tremendous pressure. They need someone standing there who can get up, who can think about things rationally, who's not as involved, who can go and get them a glass of water if they need. Some patients feel that they don't want to bother the nurse. You know, and nurses are very tremendously busy. It's hard. So they don't want to bother them. But patients need these things. So even when it comes to Chilul Shabbos, to joining someone in the hospital, there's room to discuss them. One more thing Rabbi Goldberg mentioned, I think it's important to differentiate between a proxy and a living will. A proxy is a legal document that states that if I am unable to make decisions on my own, I select X person to make decisions for me. Legally speaking, that person is speaking as if I am speaking. That person's mouth is my mouth. It's the same thing. That person is speaking for me. It's a legal document. You can find it all over the place. That's all it means. Now, I'll just suggest to you the following that I've picked up from a little bit of working with this. You can have more than one person, but they should be sequential. I've had cases where someone put down, well, they had three sons. So they said, well, if I'm unable to, then you should ask my three sons. And one, then the comma A, then comma B, comma C, and all of them disagreed. And so now what do? Legally speaking, you're in the mess. So it should be one, if he or she is not available, the next, if he or she is not available, then the third. You're doing them a tremendous chesed. It's horrible when children have to fight at the end of life. There was a case I remember years ago I was involved. Family was vacationing in Orlando with all their children and their grandchildren. It was wonderful. At one point, the grandmother says, I'm not feeling well, I have a headache. She sits down on the bench, and 2 seconds later, she passed out. She had a brain aneurysm. A brain aneurysm burst. She was in the hospital in Orlando. No, the whole family's there. And in the middle of the night, and so there are 4 children, they're all from, they said, well, what should we do? So they all belong to, they all moved out of the house. They all each called their respective rabbis, what's appropriate, and they get 4 different answers. So now, and they're all doing the right thing. They're not fighting, but they're just now at a loss. What do you do? So this woman had a living will and a proxy that said, you know, my husband should be in charge, but if there's a question, call Rabbi X. And they said, okay. That's what we'll do. We'll call Rabbi X. And whatever he says, that's what she wanted. And they called Rabbi X. And so I always tell that the yeshiva students, that, like, you might get that call at 2 in the morning. You need to know what to do. Sometimes you need to know. But it was such a chesed. Because they didn't know how to resolve that. They don't know the issue. They each got different answers. And they're trying to resolve the conflict. And it's not really a conflict. And it's a tremendous chesed to do to somebody. Just to make sure that it's very, very clear. And just one last thing, make sure the phone numbers are accurate. Happened more than once. That especially... person's not terribly familiar, double check. They had a terrible situation that ended up in court and appeals and back and forth because the phone number wasn't accurate. If they had the accurate phone number, it would have solved the problem once, and they didn't, and it was really a problem. So that's what, yeah?
Is the living will and the power of attorney for health, is it good in all states?
I'm not a legal expert. I believe so, but I don't know. I have one. I'm saying you don't have to wait till you're 119 to be 100. I have one. My wife's my proxy. I remember once we had a barbecue by my in-laws' house, and I brought out proxy statements for everyone to sign. It was a little bit morbid. But you know what? It needs to be done. So it needs to be done. So we all have proxies. Baruch Hashem, it's an important thing because you should have it on file, and it should be saved, I would suggest, even in your email. so that if you're far away, you can find it. Just mail it to yourself, email it to yourself, a copy, so you have it. All the time. All the time. So let's just talk about whether... So the living will... So that's what a proxy is. A proxy is just appoint someone to speak for me. A living will is more than that. Most living wills include a proxy. And then the living will says, well, in circumstance X, this is what I would want done. In circumstance Y, this is what I would want done, etc., 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 etc. It can be very specific. There are these documents now called MOLST and POLST, M-O-L-S-T, P-O-L-S-T, which are supposed to help you, guide you to make these decisions because, you know, a healthy person, why am I thinking about all these crazy things that might happen? This helps guide. Now, those are great, and they're helpful. The issue is that what I think about as a 35-year-old, what I might want later might change. So it's important that if you have such a document, for it to do two things. First of all, revisit every couple of years. Not every year, maybe, but every 5-10 years would be revisited. And secondly, really super important, whoever you appointed to make those decisions, have a conversation with them. They need to know. They need to know that what's going on. They don't want to just read a document. That, if that's what they have to do, they have to do. But they don't want to just read a document and then be able to speak for you. Have a conversation. It's uncomfortable. But it's a good thing. And if it's not a school of Arichas Yamim, then I think together we can give you all a bracha for Arichas Yamim if you do it. So that should the Freddy Rabbi can give bracha. So even if it's not a school, that works. So that would be that. Interestingly, all the famous cases that made it to the Supreme Court, Nancy Kruse and Karen Quinlan, Terry Schiavo, were all young women who didn't have power. They didn't have any power of attorney. They didn't have proxies. They didn't have living wills. So nobody knew what to do with them. Nobody knew. And that's why the situations developed. It just wasn't clear directive. And so that's where the situation got complicated. Sure.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but sure. I think it's really important also that, you know, we're thinking about this, we're hearing this from the perspective of ourselves, but go back and encourage your children and grandchildren. Because as Rabbi Shabtai just said, even if they're at a younger age, do you know how many young people there are who don't have a will? They have children, they're going on vacation, the mother and father together, and they don't have a will. They're not indicated who should take the children if something were to happen. So one is always better off planning and communicating. So we need to teach our children to have a will, to have a halachic living will, to have life insurance, to have disability insurance, to join the shul they go to every Shabbos and their children benefit from. There's a whole set of things. There's a whole set of things that we need to teach our children, which frankly they don't know on their own. There's no part in the educational system which teaches that to you. That's part of the Mesorah of a parent to a child, is to say, you've reached a maturity, you've reached a level, you need a will, you need life insurance, you need disability insurance, you need a halachic living will, and so on and so forth. So
shul membership.
Shul membership. We should think about this not only from the perspective of ourselves, but we should be thinking about this from the perspective of our children as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the way to approach it, because a lot of people, it gives them the heebie-jeebies, they think death is contagious, they think all kinds of things, and I think the most... Yeah, so I would just tell you, the most important thing, you know, it's a similar conversation that one has with a loved one who is determined they want to be cremated. If you're going to debate cremation, you're going to lose. But you can't debate, I love you, and I'm telling you that this will be hard for me, and if you love me, don't you want to do what's best for me? So if the conversation centers around cremation, you'll lose. If it centers around, I want you to think about your death, you'll lose. But if you make it about, I just want to confirm, do you love me? Yes. Would you ever want to hurt me? No. Would you want your children to fight? No. Would you want to cause us pain? Never. Well, great. Because there's something we need you to do, which is one of the greatest acts of love you can do. And if you don't do it, you'll be causing us pain and suffering and hurt and conflict. So if you create the conversation around love and loyalty, not around death or cremation, you have a much better shot. I just, before we can take the questions, give Rabbi Shabtai 2 more minutes
to address
at least the issue of non-heroic measures.
Not the heroic issue. So let's just talk some briefly about what, yes, I don't like the term heroic measures. I mentioned Rabbi Goldberg before. It's a term that the Catholic Church introduced. And so I don't like to use it because I have specific, not because it's a Catholic term, but because it has very specific connotations of what's necessary and what's not, and I don't know that we should be confined to those that terminology. So the question in halacha is, what do you do? Why is a dying person treated any differently than a healthy person who needs help? As Rabbi Goldberg mentioned, if he would sign a DNR, that would be absurd because he's healthy and hopefully he'll recover. So what's the difference in halacha if someone is towards the end of life and someone who's hopefully in the prime of life? What's the difference halachically? Why should I be able to treat them differently if they're alive? In halacha, we assume that everyone's either alive or dead. I know it's simple. It's a dichotomy. You can either be alive or dead. A dying person is alive. All dying people are alive. You're on one side of the line, you're on the other. Halachically speaking, a dying person is alive. So for all matters. So why do I not treat them like I treat the 25-year-old? Is there any difference? So in halacha, we distinguish between, look, the mitzvah is to help somebody. The mitzvah, the Torah says you have to go out and help someone save their life. It's an interesting place that it's learned from Hashavas Aveda. If I have to return your lost object, I have to return your lost health. The Gemara assumes that it's obvious. The Torah also says, Lo tamar al dam re'echa. You can't stand by while someone needs help. You have to do something. You standing idly by and doing nothing. So most negative prohibitions in the Torah, don't murder, don't kill, don't violate Shabbos, I fulfill them by sitting quietly. If I sit in my seat, I am fulfilling all 365 prohibitions. I'm great. I just sit quietly. This one, if you sit quietly, you violate. This one, you got to get up and do something. You have to go and take care of somebody. So the halacha is going to differentiate between treating someone in certain situations where I'm not allowed to intervene and do something that will hasten their death. I can't give them an excessive morphine injection for the purpose of euthanasia. I can certainly treat pain, and I should treat pain, and I think halachically you're obligated to treat pain, and you violate Shabbos to treat pain, and of course you have to treat pain. You have to do it smartly, you have to do it well, and they can be done. Almost always, not always. But sometimes you're allowed to not intervene. Sometimes you're allowed to not intervene. You're allowed to say, well, this therapy is, each case is going to be very individual, is more. This person needs a surgery that's emergent, and they're terminal, and the success chances are maybe yes, maybe no. In certain circumstances, we'll say, you don't have to do anything. You're not active. In certain circumstances, being passive is permissible. That's the general principle in many of these things, being active versus passive. So euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide, where someone is actively doing something to hasten their death, that's prohibited no matter what. To actively pursue hastening death is always going to be forbidden. There are going to be many circumstances, though, where, look, we need to do X in order to keep the person alive. We need to change X. They need this therapy. They need this surgery. And we're allowed to say, in that circumstance, under particular rules, then maybe you could stand by and not do something. So when they really, practically, Rabbi Goldberg mentioned coming down to a ventilator, a person on the breathing tube. So often, why is it such an issue? Because a patient's brought into the emergency room, they're not breathing. Now, the emergency room physicians, and rightfully so, are not going to start asking them, what do you think about this? Let's talk about the values in life. The person's not breathing. I don't know right now if I put them on the ventilator, if they're going to recover or not. I don't know. I don't know this patient. I have no idea. Patient's not breathing. I got to get them breathing. So you put them on the ventilator. And that's the right thing to do, because if they start having these conversations, we're going to lose patients. Now, turning off a ventilator is an active action, meaning it requires you to do something. And that's why many poskim will tell you that you can't. You can't be shut off because it requires you to do something. You have to act. And therefore, according to many poskim, not all, but according to many poskim, that's an intervention that we're not allowed to do. As opposed to a person's blood pressure is dropping, they need necessarily some extra vasopressor, they need another medication, they needed something else. Maybe, in those circumstances, sometimes you could just say, okay, we're not going to pursue that and let nature take its course by being passive. So the general overview, without getting too specific, is going to be active versus passive, because, yes, we know it comes to the same outcome. It comes to the same outcome. We understand that. Being passive in certain circumstances is going to allow the person to die. And being active in certain circumstances is going to allow the person to die. So what's the difference? Well, the halacha thinks that what we do is the difference. It's our actions that are being guided, not necessarily the outcome.
Okay, we have a few minutes left. Questions? We have a lot more we can talk about, but we want to address what's on your mind.
Sorry for going
so questions,
long.
Yes.
Yes, I wanted to know on the living will and the proxy, is it not advisable to put someone down who's older than you, or it doesn't really matter? Like, say your spouse is...
I think if you follow Rabbi Shabtai's guidance of having a sequential order, then it doesn't matter, because if the person is unavailable or not in a condition to answer, you've indicated in sequence who should go next. So it probably is not... It's fine as long as you've created... If they're the only name there, then you may have created where you don't even have a proxy. But if you have a sequential order, then you're covered.
Many of the documents have it already filled in, like this one. Otherwise, it's clear.
And they have it rabbis the same way. You name the rabbi, and if that rabbi is unavailable, who the other? Yeah. There are rabbis who don't answer their phone, shockingly. So, yes.
And the question about cremation.
Yeah.
If you have a parent who wouldn't even know the word Tara, not religious at all, can you use that same kind of argument or way to present the idea for them having Tara?
Absolutely. Even for having a Tara. I mean, I think it's a compelling argument to the person that when you're gone, the implications of these decisions only affect us, don't affect you. Meaning we believe they affect the soul in the positive sense, but if the person is not religious, they're an agnostic, they're an atheist, or even if they're religious but they're not sure about the afterlife, what you say to them is that the consequences or the implications are much greater for us than they are, from your perspective, for you. So why will it make a difference for you if you're allowing your body to be treated with respect and care and love and affection, to be washed and dressed? That may not have a great implication to you. Your soul will be extracted from the body at that point, but it will have a huge implication for us and for our comfort during our time of grief. So again, it's not a perfect strategy, and it's certainly, you can't say, always works, but I find that it is much, much better to anchor the conversation around the question of, do you love us? So for example, with the cremation question, you know, you might view this as being something which is exploitive a little bit, but sometimes I'll say, have the grandchildren call the grandparent and say, Grandma, Grandpa, Bubby, Zadie, I want to be able to visit your grave. I want to feel you're still part of my life. When I got married, I want to go tell you about it. When I have my children, I want to bring them there for you to meet them. And if you cremate yourself, you're taking that away from me. So why do you really care so much what happens? Why is cremation so... So you don't believe in the whole body and resurrection? Fine. But I'm telling you, for me, for love, wouldn't you want to not do something that would hurt me? Don't you want me to be able to feel connected to you? So again, it's not perfect. There are people set in their ways, but it's a question of how you anchor the conversation. So sometimes you can win them on the side the same way. That says, in other words, the people who believe in cremation don't so much believe in cremation, but it's a statement of rebellion against believing in the traditional perspective. So what you could say is, I'm not asking you to believe in the traditional perspective. I'm not asking you to believe in God or keep Shabbos or kosher. I'm not asking you to come to shul. I'm just telling you that this is a love issue. Do you want there to be discord? Do you want there to be animosity or tension between us? We can relieve that tension if you're willing to on this. You know, we all have to make concessions in life. But are you willing to be flexible here? Because it will lead to loyalty and love and affection there. Gigi, you had a question.
I was just going to say, maybe the shul should put out some kind of an outline or a guideline so that the community know what's going on.
With
not just not limited to right here.
Right.
That's
a good idea. Rabbi Shabtai is going to work on it right after this.
I have a whole list of things I'm supposed to talk about also. I will look at that list. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could address the issue that woman brought up about it's almost like the people of the AIM issue when your elderly parents refuse, even when they are halachically observant, to deal with, you know, Mayav Esrim issues.
Right, so that's what we suggested, is that make it about love, not the Mayav Esrim issues. Make it about, don't you want to make my life easier? Don't you want to take away the trauma and the pain? Wouldn't you want to remove suffering? And that's your best shot.
And reverse it and say, well, dealing with that is causing us suffering, so you have to respect the fact that we don't move suffering. Does the shul, or does the community have any vehicle or committee of rabbis
would
then try to intervene?
Sure. We can always come up with a strategy. Beth.
With regard to what you had mentioned about Rosh Hashanah having an active and passive involvement, and your parents involved in hospice, is there any guidance besides the specific examples you just gave? Is there anywhere that you would look maybe understand this a bit better? I mean, specifically, I do understand the difference between active and passive, but when you put it into something that I'm going through right now, so I'm so sorry
okay.
That I can't speak well. What do you get?
So I'm sorry to hear that you're going through it. it's very usually very patient specific. So that's a conversation that we can have. There are some resources out there. There's some articles about. I can share them with you. I have to find them. Maybe topic for a new book, but been thinking about it for a while.
The articles, Beth, they may not be comforting because they're written academically. There's footnotes and sources. They'll quote all the Talmudic arguments. They're not, I don't know if you're aware, there's not really a guide from a traditional Jewish perspective to end of life that kind of just gives you bullets or sensitively gives you paragraphs, mostly because it is so specific to each case. But those people who have the interest in this also have the interest in addressing it kind of academically and scholarly rather than necessarily pastoral.
I'll have to ask Rabbi Goldberg to write the introductory couple of chapters and then we can put it together. We'll work on that next. Okay.
Feel free to follow up with Rabbi Shabtai or any of us if you have specific questions. Denise.
What are the ones that, as an observant Jew, you need to fight for, as the advocate for your loved one? What are the things that you have to kind of dig your heels in on? Like, what are the things that you can't compromise on? You know, there are certain things you should be able to compromise on to keep peace in the family, but what are the lines in the sand?
So I try not to give lines in the sand, again, because it's very, very specific. Oxygen, nutrition, we think that, you know, routine maintenance things that keep a person alive at a regular, it's a little bit of line in the sand because you can push it, it's a little bit vague, so it's not very specific. Usually these decisions don't need to be made on the spot, usually because we could usually just continue it for a little bit longer, usually. Not always.
Intubation needs to be made
on the spot. That's why we have cell phones.
Right, and Rabbi Shabtai's point is, and again, maybe this is a good way to end and summarize because it comes full circle. When a patient is heading in a certain direction, before they get there, there's an opportunity for a family to meet and to talk to a doctor, to talk to their rabbi, and to kind of come up with a game plan before they encounter the situation so that they don't have to make the real-time situation. They can strategize a little bit beforehand. So that's really worthwhile to do. And again, Mashabtai can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding again is that to deprive oxygen is to suffocate to death, to deprive nutrition is to starve to death. Now, sometimes the oxygen and nutrition are counterindicated because the person's going to aspirate if you provide the nutrition, or it could create infection if you put in the PEG or intravenous. So if it's counterindicated, of course you shouldn't do it because that's going to hasten death, which is being avoided. But unless it's going to be counterindicated, oxygen and nutrition are basic, what was your term?
Routine maintenance care,
that might be the line of the sand. Right. We could talk about this for hours. You want to say
that's why I don't like to give specifics, because every medical condition is specific. But I think what's most important, I think, to have these conversations, we're happy to speak with families, with doctors. Sometimes when the doctors speak to the rabbis, it alleviates a lot of tension. I know I do it, I think Rabbi Goldberg does it. Having the conversations is helpful. I think that's our general message.
We could talk for hours. Unfortunately, we're out of time, and you have to get to your next sessions. But we're happy to continue the conversation.